Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Good evening. You're listening to the Flixwise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. Returning to Flixwise in his second appearance is renowned film historian, author, and professor emeritus from Indiana University, Mr. James Naremore. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you, Pauline. Nice to hear from you again.
Yes, thank you for agreeing to join me again.
Well, we'll see what happens.
A warning to our listeners with delicate sensibilities. This episode is going to feature some pretty graphic subject matter. We're talking sex, murder, blood, brassieres, sex. Filthy, really. After listening to this episode, you may even find yourself in need of a shower. That's because today's Sight and Sound entry is the 34th greatest movie of all time, the 1960 horror classic Psycho. Our guest, Mr. Naremore, wrote a book called A Film Guide to Psycho, so hopefully he's equipped to show us around the Bates Hotel and explain the film's cultural significance. Then, in a shocking twist, we're going to talk about more Hitchcock. Bet you didn't see that coming. Since we are releasing this episode on August 11th, 2 days before Alfred's 126th birthday, we thought it would be a nice tribute to the man to discuss not only his filmography, but also how he became the public face of the movie director profession. Finally, we're going to close things out with an update on some of Jim's current projects. Jim, you ready to check in?
Okay, let's see. Let's see what happens.
Okay, all right, you grab the baggage. This September marks the 25th anniversary of the release of one of cinema's most notorious horror flicks, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. When the film first hit the big screen in 1960, theatergoers were asked not to reveal the big twist that comes approximately midway through the film. Jim and I, however, will make no such courtesy. If you have not seen Psycho and are unfamiliar with the events of the film, you're probably an infant and won't be able to comprehend what we're saying anyway. But if there are any full-grown adults who haven't seen it, be forewarned. We're going to talk in detail about the stuff that happens in the movie. All right, you ready? Here it is. In the first portion of the film, we delve into the life of a woman named Marion Crane, who's played by Janet Leigh. Marion appears dissatisfied with her Phoenix, Arizona existence. She's unmarried. She's living with her sister. She's stuck in a thankless job working as an assistant in a real estate office. And she's involved in a humiliating dead-end love affair. Her every gesture conveys a sense of overwhelming shame and melancholy. That is, until she steals 40 grand from a wealthy client and books it out of town. Exhausted and eager to avoid detection, she stops into a motel far from the main highway. The motel is run by a curious fellow named Norman Bates, who fixes Marion up some dinner and sits with her as she eats. Norman seems friendly enough, but he clearly doesn't get out much. First of all, he's really into taxidermy, which is kind of weird. But even more disconcerting is his attachment to a senile mother, whom he talks about at length. When Marion is finished with her food, she extricates herself from the increasingly awkward conversation and turns in for the night. In the following scene, Marion hops in the shower and is stabbed to death. Yep, stabbed to death. It turns out that what we were led to believe to be a cat-and-mouse chase kind of movie is actually the story of a serial killer. A serial killer with multiple personality disorder who, when he becomes attracted to a woman, takes on his mother's persona and cuts down the unsuspecting object of his desire. This film caused quite a stir when it was released. But does the shock and terror of Psycho still register with modern audiences? Let us discuss. All right, Jim, this is a silly question, but do you like Psycho?
Of course I do.
Yeah.
Although it's interesting, it took me a little while to really realize what a great film it was.
Mm. Why do you think that is?
It had to do the circumstances under which I first saw it. I saw the film when it was first released. I'm admitting how very old I am.
Mm.
And I can remember I saw it in New Orleans, Louisiana, at the Lowe's Theater. There had been, you know, a huge buzz about the film. It had been attracting crowds, and I knew a little about what it was going to be, and I was a fan of Hitchcock. I mean, he had always been a director who I was really interested in, and I never lost that interest. And I had seen several of his films when I was in high school, And I wanted to see this one if for no other reason than to see Janet Leigh in her brassiere.
Right. As good a reason as any.
Yeah. And so I went with the crowd to this theater, and it was the most carnivalistic experience I have ever had in a movie theater. It was such pandemonium during the shower scene and so forth. And the audience couldn't keep quiet after that. It was all, so the psychiatrist explaining everything at the end, that was just washed out by everybody's nervous talk and so forth. And everybody, a lot of people felt like they weren't fooled when it's revealed who Mrs. Bates really is. Mm. But that didn't stop them from being scared to death.
Yeah.
So anyway, I saw the film, but it was just such an intense experience with that audience. It was hard for me to get any aesthetic handle on it. I just thought, wow, this is some kind of great gimmick film. And I just didn't think about it as a great film. It scared me. I suppose a lot of people, the idea of being attacked in the shower, made you afraid of taking a shower literally for a while. Or at least you got a kind of spooky feeling that way. But it was only much later, after I had become a professor and so forth and was just beginning to write about movies, I showed the film to my students, and it scared them to death. But I realized this is really a great film. Formally, it's brilliant. Even if you know how it ends, if you know the trick and so forth, it still is a film that you can sit back and admire for its ideas. And it's just an aesthetically accomplished film. And in some ways, like a lot of Hitchcock's work in this period, a movie about movies. Mm-hmm. And so that it took me a while to dawn on me. And then Harry Gettle and Ron Gottesman gave me the chance to write a little monograph in a series that they did on major films. And I had the chance to write about Psycho. And I was eager to do it. I mean, I knew that it was a great film, but I was afraid to do it. Afraid because this was before the digital era. So, okay, I had a 16 millimeter print of the film, and I had an editing gizmo, a wind thing. Mm-hmm. And I was going to do close reading of the film. And I just worried that if I looked at those images over and over again, I would not be able to sleep.
Yeah.
But they dissipated.
Yes. But how were you, you mentioned like the marketing of the film. Guess I talked in the intro about the marketing.
Well, you,
of the film.
I don't know if I guess everybody knows this now, but this was in my day when you went to movies back in that ancient time, and unless it was some kind of special attraction movie, you just went in whenever you wanted to. I mean, that's how that expression, "This is where I came in," originated. Mm. I would pay my 25 cents or whatever and go sit in the theater. And when the feature ended, I would stay until the point where I'd come in. And a lot of people did that. So it was not uncommon for people to walk in the middle of a movie. Hitchcock made a rule. Again, it was a great ploy that no one would be admitted to the theater after the movie had begun. And that just heightened everybody's curiosity about the movie. So,
right, exactly, yeah.
But also, it's true. If it's a movie that, if you don't watch it from the beginning, you even if you know what's going to happen, you kind of lose, I don't know, your engagement with the movie.
Yeah. Well, it's some people have said that the first half of the film is kind of a red herring, and that the Marion Crane story has very little to do with the actual point of the movie. Do you think that's true?
No, not at all. I think there are motifs from the first half that carry over into the second half.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't anything terribly profound, but the bird image, for example, mm-hmm. is Phoenix, Arizona.
Yes.
And her name is Marion Crane. And and Janet Leigh has, I think, a sort of bird-like quality to her body. Anyway, so there's imagery in the first half. There's also a kind of symmetry in that the first half of the movie is about as kind of drab and funky as you can get. It's afternoon sex in a hotel room, a real estate office that's obviously a terrible place to have to work,
right.
the American Road, motel. I mean, it's all those dreary things. At certain places, it gets into sort of like what Edgar Ulmer's movie Detour is like, you know, the sort of empty spaces of America and the drabness of everything. And then suddenly when you get to the motel and you switch over, there's this Gothic mansion. Right. And now you're in James Whale country, you know, and it's like two different Americas, a kind of a Victorian America and a modern America. And I think the film was designed to be that way. Mm. It's great that it takes a long time for us to get to the shower scene, and I think audiences may not have known what was coming, Hitchcock really does take time with that, and it's not all that terribly interesting or suspenseful. It just takes quite a while to get to that point, but once that kicks in, you're in a different place. So there's a— I wouldn't call it a red herring at all. I think you're just carefully prepared for the shock that's going to come.
Yeah.
And that there are these nice formal symmetries in the film, too. So.
Absolutely. Does the first half of the film sort of set you up as a voyeur? And then when the actual murder comes, it's sort of playing a big trick on you.
Yeah, yeah. I think in that period of his career, which I guess I would have to argue is the greatest period of Hitchcock's career, his films
specifically the years.
Well, the Paramount films, the ones made in the 50s, leading up to Psycho, and then the loan out to MGM for North by Northwest. But it's those 50s and early 60s films that I think are so terrific. But something in that period, in the 50s, Hitchcock really became increasingly interested. And I think building up to Psycho, he was interested, I think, in it's pretty obvious, really. He's interested in the theme of voyeurism. He's interested in the relationship between the viewer and the audience and the screen, and in implicating the audience in ways that maybe the audience doesn't even understand. Obviously that's key in Rear Window, in Vertigo. And there's a scene in North by Northwest, the scene where Cary Grant escapes and climbs up to the villain's mansion and it's peering through the window trying to rescue Eva Marie Saint. That just kind of a lesson in Kuleshovian or subjective editing. And I think he was very interested in that. And so here in Psycho, though I think it has a lot to do with in Vertigo with the sort of pornographic lure that movies have, the perversity of voyeurism. So it's like he you enjoy the movie, but you feel guilty. If you're self-conscious about what the movie's doing, you feel guilty about enjoying it in some way.
Right. You mentioned that this film is in a lot of ways about filmmaking. Is that kind of what you were referring to?
Yes, that's what I mean. Yeah. I think Hitchcock, of course, is— I don't know exactly why this is the case. It may be that it just became so attached to him that other filmmakers can't really do it without seeming like him. Brian De Palma does it all the time. This sense of the subjective camera, of looking through a character's eyes, and cutting back and forth between a close-up and what the character sees. It's a very old, technique in movie making, but he really, out of that kind of simple classical form, did some brilliant stuff.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the theme, the motif of the birds.
Yeah.
Obviously, Hitchcock's got a thing for birds. He made a whole movie called The Birds. What are they doing in this film as opposed to, say, The Birds or any of the other films that feature birds?
Yeah, I'm always a little reluctant to speak about things as symbols, because I think often audiences think that that's some kind of secret code. The bird stands for this. I don't think it does. I think you have to just look at particular instances. Psycho grew out of Hitchcock's television series. which was one of the most popular things in America. And that Alfred Hitchcock TV show made Hitchcock a celebrity unlike any other movie director had ever been. I mean, he was a weekly star on television. He had been on TV and on radio and so before, but this really solidified it. And one of the films that was done for that series, one of the several that Hitchcock himself directed, was a movie called Banquo's Chair, and it's got lots of Bird references in it, and it's made right before Psycho. So I don't know, it's like he was a run up to Psycho in some way.
Yeah.
And it's interesting in Psycho, the film is based on what I think is a rather bad novel. In the novel, the taxidermy motif is there, but it's not about birds. You know, there's just all kinds of various animals. Mm-hmm. And here it becomes a complete fascination with birds. And it may have something to do with enhancing the voyeuristic qualities that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, especially in that scene where Norman Bates and Marion are meet and have the conversation in the parlor in the motel where she's eating a sandwich and talking to him, there's this really menacing bird over his head, and there's an owl and so forth. And sometimes he himself seems like a victim of the birds, and sometimes he seems to be one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to be kind of predatory birds. So I don't know, maybe Hitchcock just had an anxiety about birds.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah. But
I think you said Janet Leigh has some bird-like qualities, but
yes.
I also think
yes.
Norman Bates does, especially the way he's
yes,
eating the candy
absolutely.
Corn.
No, that obviously that shot was designed to make him look like a bird. It's like he's
and he's the way he's got these delicate features. He seems so the way he's built.
No, he's obviously, it was a brilliant stroke of casting, and one of those roles that an actor never lives down. He can never escape it. You know? Yeah.
Exactly. I think that's true of both of them. Both Janet Leigh and Anthony Perkins are so strongly associated with this film.
Yeah, although I think, I'm trying to think about Janet's subsequent career, but she made some terrific films around this time, but I guess... Mm-hmm. She got attacked in a motel twice, and she's always going to be thought of that way.
Exactly, I assume you're referring to Touch of Evil, the Orson Welles film.
Yeah.
Which Orson Welles claimed that, or he suspected that Hitchcock saw Touch of Evil prior to making Psycho, and that's where
Peter Bogdanovich seems to think that as well.
Mm-hmm.
The two films have an amazing amount of things in common. Of course, Welles is first. The camera operator on Touch of Evil, Russell, is the photographer for Psycho. And the set designer, one of the set designers for Touch of Evil, is a set designer on Psycho. And Mort Mills, character actor, plays in both films. He's the highway patrolman who stops Janet Leigh in Psycho. And he's the, what is he? He's a kind of lawyer, policeman, or whatever in Touch of Evil as well.
Oh.
So anyway, there are all these little things in there. But I think Hitchcock's treatment of the motel material is scary in a different way. And I think it is 180 degrees. Welles' approach to the material is 180 degrees stylistically different from Hitchcock, because Hitchcock is a kind of classicist who understates everything until the moment of shock. And Welles is more kind of Baroque, you know, the wide angles and so forth. And all you have to do is compare Perkins's performance in Psycho with Dennis Weaver in Touch of Evil.
Right.
The Dennis Weaver role is just really freaked out. You know, it's so stylized. It's a kind of Shakespearean comic or something like that.
Yeah.
So the whole, the tone and style is different, but yet similar.
Yeah. Back to the production of the film.
Uh-huh.
This was made sort of on the cheap because Hitchcock made some deal with Paramount, right?
Well, he already had the deal with Paramount. He was contracted with them, and he was hugely successful, with the television show and everything. Mm-hmm. And his Paramount films had done well, and they were usually glossily produced. But I think he was unsure about the subject matter of this film and thought he might be taking a big risk. So it wasn't so much the studio, but Hitchcock himself who did it in a moderate way. And and it's done in the style of the TV films, which were black and white films. And it was kind of unusual at this period for Hitchcock to be making a black and white film, and black and white films, period. They were kind of associated with, I don't know, I guess, art films by this time. But they were associated with TV. So this used a photographer from the TV show. Russell was a good one. Worked fast.
Yeah. And you say John Russell was the DP on this?
Right. Robert Burks was the other great cameraman who did all the really fantastic color films in this period of Hitchcock. He did Vertigo. And Hitchcock normally worked with him, but he went with Russell. Let me go to Bernard Herrmann for a minute, because I also heard Bernard Herrmann talk about this. When Hitchcock went to Herrmann about the score for the film, he said, "You can do anything you want to with the music, but I don't want any music in the shower scene." And Herrmann followed orders, and the film, when the film was all set to go and Hitchcock looked at it, he was really disappointed. Hitchcock was disappointed when, according to what Herrmann said, he wasn't sure they should release it. He thought about maybe making it a 2-episode version of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, although I don't know how graphic you could be on TV at that time, but he did think about that idea. And Herrmann said to him, "Look, let me do some music for the shower scene." Mm-hmm. And that was what did it.
In a lot of ways, that's the most famous part of the movie.
Yeah.
The music, it's the score. The part people remember. Yeah, it's the score.
Herrmann said he wanted it to be a black and white music. Mm-hmm. And he meant by that, I think, that it's all a string score. There's nothing else, nothing but strings in it.
Yeah, but it's so unlike anything else.
I don't know what it is. I'm not a musician enough to be able to identify it, but I can recognize a Bernard Herrmann score any time. And I guess it has to do with the orchestration or something musically that he repeats. I don't know.
Well, in this one, it's almost like Mickey Mousing. Like the sound of the strings, the high pitched violins.
It brings another bird motif into it too. You know, those strings sound like shrill bird cries almost.
Absolutely. Really quickly, back to the use of the John Russell as the cameraman.
Yeah.
Why did Hitchcock go for the television aesthetic as opposed to his usual cameraman? You know, the usual color, vibrant. Yeah.
Well, I think as I was saying, I think it was economic reasons. He wasn't confident that the thing would succeed, so he wanted to keep it to a relatively low budget. But also, he wanted it to be like the TV series. That TV series was like, I don't know, virtually the number one TV show in America at that time, and so audiences were primed. They really enjoyed the TV show, and the movie was going to look something like it, but it was going to have a lot of sensational elements as well. Mm-hmm. So that's a stylistic. And Russell, by the way, is a very good photographer. I think I'm trying to remember. I'd have to look this up. I think he photographed Park Row for Sam Fuller, and he was the photographer for Macbeth. And once again, that was a Welles's Macbeth was a B movie production.
Yes.
Very, very relatively cheaply done at Republic Studios. So Russell was a photographer who worked in low budget films.
Interesting. He's good at making cheap stuff look expensive, maybe. I think it's a very visually inventive film.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's nothing cheesy about the photography in Psycho.
Exactly. Yeah, it
just happens to be black and white. That's right. All. I mean,
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but we've talked about this film as maybe the prototype for a lot of the tropes used in slasher films throughout the ages. They're still being used today. Yeah. But do you think that one needs to enjoy slasher movies to enjoy this film?
No, because I don't enjoy slasher movies. I'm not a fan of slasher movies. No, this one is different to me.
Yeah.
It obviously, though, is highly influential. I mean, so many films were influenced by it. Mm-hmm.
I don't like slasher movies either, but this one, mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I think it's so funny.
I think formally the film is fascinating, and I think that the characters in the latter part of the film, you know, Vera Miles and John Gavin, are never really developed very much. They're mm-hmm. just kind of agents that carry you through the film. But the Janet Leigh character and the Tony Perkins character are really interesting in the film. They're more subtle characterizations, more interesting characterizations than you get in the average horror movie, I think.
Absolutely. And that's just obviously the Hitchcock wit.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yes. That's the other thing that's it's always very important with Hitchcock, the sense of humor. And he always said, in defending Psycho against people who thought it was barbaric, that he thought the film had a sense of humor, mm-hmm. and that if it had not had this sense of humor, it would be unwatchable. It would just be horrible.
Yeah.
So there's always in Hitchcock this. Sometimes it crosses over the line, but it's this kind of humor noir, black humor. Yeah. It's in lots of other places. It's in Kubrick. It's in Kafka. It's in most of the surrealists, that's what makes it both fascinating and fun in some right. strange way.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, most slasher films don't have the aesthetic beauty of this film, and that's not to say like the shower scene is. I enjoy watching it, but there is something about the symmetry between the images,
uh-huh.
you know, the round, the circular objects cutting to other
yes,
circular objects.
Yes, and yes,
there's just something, there's so much care taken, particularly mm-hmm. in that scene, which notoriously, apparently 70 cuts in there.
I think I counted them from someplace. Yeah, but actually, that's not very much cutting the way they do it nowadays.
Yeah, yeah.
Digital editing has made people too sloppy and cut too fast. And anyway, it just becomes chaotic. In the case of the interesting thing about Hitchcock is through that, what seems a highly chaotic scene, you never lose perspective on anything.
Right, it all makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a spatial awareness there.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, it is sort of expressionistic.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a collage of murder.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
One criticism that people have of the film is of the ending. And the
yes.
long spiel
yes.
with the
yes.
psychiatrist.
Yes.
What do you make of that?
Well, I've never been happy with the psychiatrist spiel. And audiences are now so hip to irony and everything that they tend to laugh during, oh, he's a transvestite, not a transvestite. He's a so-and-so. I think, you know, to me, there people have tried to find subtleties in that. But I think it's... You know, it's one of the dated parts of the movie. Mm-hmm. I think Hitchcock was trying to. There had been so much packed into those last few minutes. Where, and by the way, my experience showing this to students who've not seen it before, that the loudest screams come not in the shower scene, but when Lila starts to go down to the basement toward the end. You remember?
Yes.
They never fail to start screaming at that moment. It's a really scary moment. And so an awful lot of things are revealed in very fast few moments there. A lot happens. And the audience needs that psychiatrist to come in and calm them down a little bit. As I mm-hmm. said to you the first time I saw it, the audience was talking. They were so shaken up by everything that they couldn't stop talking after a shock came. And the psychiatrist just sort of, you know, he helps people who didn't get it get it in some way or another. So,
right. It, on the one hand, it definitely serves to hold people's hands and explain what happened. But on the other hand, it's this also, and as you said, it's a way for audiences to sort of reach an equilibrium.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it goes on for such a long time.
Yes, it does. Yeah, yeah.
And, but it's almost like you reach that equilibrium and then you're still in the scene and you're still in the scene. And then it's almost, you get comfortable. It's almost boring.
Yeah, and then the big payoff comes at the end.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just because you think you're safe. But then I think, to me, the scene that sends the chills every time is that ending with the voiceover.
Yeah. And of course, you know, it's significant that it's a direct address to the audience.
Right.
So,
I mean, Hitchcock's still got one more trick up his sleeve. Yeah. It's amazing. anyway, so just to wrap things up, this is the 34th movie on the Sight and Sound critics poll. Do you think it is worthy of the 34th spot? Should it be higher?
I mean, sure. It's worthy of 34. It's worthy of number one if you want to do that. Sure. Yeah. I mean, why not? You know, these things are all sort of relative in what you pick out.
34 is good. I think it could go a little higher, personally.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't be, let's put it this way, I wouldn't be surprised if it had been in the top 10.
Yeah, yeah. I say next time we bump it up a few notches.
Okay.
Now we're going to go from Hitchcock to, well, more Hitchcock. I know there are several other of old Alfred's films on the Sight and Sound list, Rear Window and North by Northwest, for instance. But those movies probably won't come up 2 days before Hitch's birthday on August 13th. Though given his delight for the macabre, it might be more appropriate for us to celebrate on the man's death day. But, oh well, next time. For now, we're going to take this occasion to take a broader view of the master of suspense. Yes, we're going to talk about our personal favorites, but we're also going to talk about some of his less than totally successful films, plus films of his that we feel deserve greater attention. We sort of touched on this in the first half, but what are the characteristics that define a Hitchcock film? When we talk about Hitchcock, what are we talking about exactly?
Most people would say it's the art of suspense and anxiety, that's what they think of in Hitchcock, and that's certainly not wrong. And suspense and anxiety mingled with a kind of wit and dark humor, that's there. I think transcending that, Hitchcock was he didn't get a chance to prove this much because he became such a star director and so much associated with, I guess you would call it a genre, or maybe it's the Hitchcock film. Mm-hmm. I mean, so that he just did the same subject matter always. He didn't try to vary from it a lot, but he was a tremendously effective filmmaker, period. And I think it's because he took such a sort of more or less scientific approach to the art of movie making. He was a brilliant constructor of narrative, meaning doling out information to an audience in a form that makes the audience want to know what happens next or holds their attention. There's I think it's in David Selznick's memo, that book of his memos. Selznick was making Gone with the Wind at the time he hired Hitchcock or contracted Hitchcock to make Rebecca. And at one point, he asked for Hitchcock's advice for something in Gone with the Wind. Mm. And Hitchcock wrote a little note to him saying, this scene is not working because you need to cut away from it. Or you need to show some people over here and come back here and over here. And it was a masterpiece. Selznick did not do it, but it was just a simple matter of constructing the narrative logic in a way that kept the audience kind of more engaged
I was hoping we could have added Hitchcock to the name of directors on Gone with the Wind.
No, he didn't direct anything. No.
That would have been cool. Yeah, I'd like to think Hitchcock was involved with the production of Gone with the Wind, because really, who wasn't?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But as you say, that we do think of Hitchcock as a genre.
Yeah.
Almost. Yeah. But the films aren't always all that similar.
North by Northwest. He actually made a musical at one point in his career. And, he departed from the thriller mainly early in his career. Mm-hmm. One of my very favorite films of his is not a thriller. It's a silent movie called The Ring.
Hmm.
And I just think it's a tremendously interesting silent movie.
Did he make The Ring?
1927. So it's right on the edge of sound. And it's the screenplay was by Hitchcock and Alma Hitchcock, whatever you want to call her.
Yeah, his wife.
And it's a boxing movie. Mm. It's a romance and a boxing movie.
Mm. And what about it? Is there anything trademark Hitchcock, or is it?
And other than the fact that it's brilliantly made and edited. A lot of the Hitchcock style depends on what we were talking about before, that kind of he was influenced by the Soviets. I think he read Pudovkin and maybe Kuleshov. I don't know. I'm pretty sure he read Pudovkin. And he may have, I guess Eisenstein wasn't translated into English until the 30s. But anyway, Hitchcock was a kind of technical scholar of the films. And he started out, as a sketch artist, or as somebody who drew the little illustrations that sometimes would accompany titles in silent movies.
Mm-hmm.
So he liked the storyboard idea, the sketching idea, and his films have that kind of rigor of a classically clear storyboard development. Anyway, that's
There are a couple of I don't want to say outliers, but there's some unusual films in his filmography.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But before we get into that, do you have a top three?
I like Rear Window, mm-hmm. and I like North by Northwest, and I like Psycho. So I guess those would be my top three. And Vertigo is close on its heels, although Hitchcock would have probably put Vertigo as number one.
Okay. Yeah. I think Psycho is probably my top.
Uh-huh.
But I love The Birds.
Uh-huh.
And I actually love Rebecca, which is...
Yeah, sure. Hey, listen, there are so many great Hitchcock films. Yeah. It's pretty hard to pin them down.
Yeah.
But, oh, God, there's so many good ones. I think he went through a little bit of a slack period when he left Selznick and became his own producer. He made some interesting films like Under Capricorn.
Yes.
Which is a brilliant film. Unfortunately, we don't have a good print of it. But he was losing box office appeal, and I think he didn't really make a big comeback until Strangers on a Train. But anyway.
Yeah. Why Under Capricorn, was that a bomb? Was that successful?
My impression was it was a failure, and Hitchcock had his own production company at that time. The other film that he made in that production company was Rope. I enjoy watching Rope, but mainly as a technical experiment. I think what's wrong with Rope is the casting of Jimmy Stewart.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who would you cast in the part?
I don't know. James Mason would have been good.
Ah.
Jimmy Stewart is too much a kind of a... I can't believe him as a teacher who, in order to buy the what's happening there, the two murderers had a teacher who taught them Nietzsche and various radical ideas.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Stewart is just too straight arrow.
Yeah, I buy that. I think James Mason would be a great choice.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I'm not that big into Rope.
Yeah.
Other films have obviously tried to replicate that same experiment.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that it's all that successful in Rope. It's more of a novelty.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually, I think it's Hitchcock's first color film, too. People don't, they always talk about the long takes in it, but it's his use of color, I think, is interesting in the film.
Trying all kinds of new things.
Uh-huh.
I think it's interesting to note what a really brilliant filmmaker does if they're doing something wrong, or
or tries to do something different, or something. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, actually, one of the films of his that I like the best, and most people would say that it's a failure, it was a box office failure, is The Wrong Man.
Okay.
And that is his, I believe it's correct to say that that is his most humorless film.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that The Wrong Man is maybe, for me, the most depressing classic Hollywood film.
But it's your favorite?
It's not my favorite Hitchcock, yeah. but I rank it up there really high. I may be unique in that regard, but I think
I think it's been reevaluated, though. I think people
probably a lot of people get around to it. I saw it when I was a kid, and it really struck me. I thought, oh, this is what the art of movie making really is.
Underrated classic. I was not expecting much from Stage Fright.
Uh-huh.
But I loved it.
Yeah, Stage Fright's fun.
I think it's a blast.
Mm-hmm.
It's got, plus anything with Marlena Dietrich.
Yeah. The theater was one of Hitchcock's preoccupations.
Mm.
He turns to the theater quite often. 39 Steps, for example,
mm-hmm.
and I think before he became a film director, or maybe while he was first getting involved in the movie business, he was pretty crazy about the theater. He hung out there a lot and went to the theater a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes all the world's a stage kind of idea with him. And whenever he returns to the theater background, he always does interesting things.
Yeah. And I just think he's having a blast with that one. And plus, it's a kind of a corrective to some of the other ones, like even Rebecca, a film that I love, or Suspicion, where you have the innocent young girl in the beginning, the naive uh-huh. young girl who ends up with a jerk who in the end turns out not to be a jerk.
Right, right.
And in Stage Fright, the jerk in the beginning is an even bigger jerk at the end.
Yeah, but in a way, I think audiences and even Hitchcock felt maybe he had done something wrong in that film because it has a lying flashback.
And the
norm is that the audience sees a character saying, this is what happens, and we flashback to something. We see it, and so we think, oh, if I've seen it, it's true. but no.
I know, that's such a great trick.
So it's kind of cheating, don't you think?
A little bit.
I don't know.
I thought it was delightful.
Yeah.
So any other maybe underrated classics?
Underrated. Well, there's so many classics, you know.
Yeah.
I can't think of any other director who made so many impressive films. Maybe Hawks might be up there with him, if you just sort of count the numbers. Maybe Ford. I don't know.
Yeah.
But there are just so many good Hitchcock movies that the quality stays pretty high all the time.
But there are a couple on there that I don't think are quite as good, and I wonder why those don't work. So
which ones don't work for you?
I don't like Torn Curtain, especially.
Yeah, I don't either. And I think although the killing scene in Torn Curtain
that's
quite a good scene.
Yes.
And the whole film kind of I think revolves around that.
Yeah.
That doesn't work.
It's a shame because you think Paul Newman. I like Paul Newman. Yeah, Julie
sure.
Andrews. Love
yeah,
Julie
it,
Andrews.
It should work.
Yeah.
Although Newman is not a Hitchcock actor, he should be able to be okay in it. It doesn't have Bernard Herrmann.
Mm.
And I think that there's something that happens in the 70s. The culture changes in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a period when this kind of movie isn't making much inroads at the box office, and I think Hitchcock kind of loses some of his steam there. He gets rid of Bernard Herrmann, which was a huge mistake,
mm-hmm.
and Robert Burks, his big photographer, dies in a fire.
Mm. Yeah,
I can remember being in London in 1963, 64, whatever, and Hard Day's Night opened. And so I go downtown, and across the street from Hard Day's Night, Marnie was playing.
Yeah.
So I had to decide, what am I going to do? Where am I going to go? And I went to see Marnie.
Ah.
That shows where my
loyalties lie.
Interests were. Yeah. For me, Marnie is, I guess you could call it, like Shakespeare has these, they used to call them problem plays. You couldn't figure out how to deal with them, and some of these late Hitchcock films are they're not bad films, but they're kind of problem films in one way or another.
Yeah. Has there been any kind of second look, sort of revival of the later period Hitchcock? Like
Well,
I
he has many fans. I mean, and a lot of really distinguished writers have loved Marnie, for example, and I don't, you know, I yeah, I mean, you could always construct an argument about these. I'm just talking about my personal,
Right, exactly.
yeah.
Yeah, there's something about, I think filmmakers like Billy Wilder had this problem too, where
Yeah, yeah.
you they're the confines of the studio system and the production code made
Right.
allowed creativity to flourish. And it's you know, if you're a
Yeah.
practical joker, if you're someone who's interested in pushing boundaries,
Yeah. And there aren't any boundaries to push anymore in a way. So,
right,
yeah.
exactly, then what do you do?
Yeah.
But when people, let's talk about Hitchcock as a celebrity. How did he become kind of the face of the film director for so many people?
There were some other film directors that were as famous as Hitchcock, you know, in the past. I think Frank Capra would have been as well known to the audience as Hitchcock. And I'm talking about now in the 30s and 40s and 50s. DeMille was well known. DeMille is an example, sort of like Hitchcock in a way. He's associated with a certain kind of historical filmmaking, you know. So DeMille is kind of a brand name that applies to a genre as well. But also, DeMille would always put his own face in the publicity of the film. He would be, he would be starring in the preview. He would be sometimes even just introducing the film. And DeMille also had a very, very popular radio program, Lux Theater. It was an adaptation of movies on and he was the impresario of that. So his name was extremely well known to the public, and Capra's name was well known. And there were other people, but Hitchcock is sort of like DeMille in a way, because he was an amusing personality who could show up on the radio and charm people. This is the British eccentric and amusing fellow, and he found ways of publicizing himself. He got his name pretty prominently displayed on the films, and then, as I say, by the time the Hitchcock TV show came around, then it really, really took off.
Did he ever want to be an actor?
I don't think he ever wanted to be an actor, no, but
He became one.
he could have been one. Now he created a character which he played.
Aside from his cameos, he never starred in any of his movies.
No.
Just found a way to publicize himself in addition to his movies. But as we say, like most all of his films are worth seeing. Some stand out more than others. And Vertigo is the number one film on the Sight and Sound list.
Have you already had a program about
I
Vertigo?
have had a program about Vertigo, yes. So he seems to just still keep growing in esteem.
You know, it's
Is
interesting. I don't know if I can fully explain this, but the late great critic Gilberto Perez, in one of his books, remarks just in passing that the literature on Hitchcock outpaces that of any other director considerably. And so, to deserve so much attention, he says, you would have to be incomparably the greatest director of all time. And that's interesting. I mean, that it could be that Hitchcock is the most incomparable director of all time, simply because he spawned so much literature about him. On the other hand, there's something about, I would say, Hitchcock is a kind of director who might fascinate English majors, let's say. He's a kind of popular entertainer who's not exactly an intellectual, but he's wittier and classier than other popular entertainers. So he gets a fan club that way, and with people who are kind of literate, more or less, like him. And then it seems like every development film theory that comes along when film studies gets established uses Hitchcock as an example, or Mulvey and Raymond Bellur. I can just go on and on, key figures who write about Hitchcock. And so he becomes not just a celebrity or a brand or what like they call it today, or a talented director, but he becomes a certain kind of idea about cinema. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you could say Eisenstein is one of those kind of directors. Wells is one of those kind of directors. But I mean, I think Godard called him the master of the universe. He is a truly classic director. He never breaks the rules, except in a like killing off the star early on. But I mean, he doesn't break the rules of the way you photograph a film and the way you edit a film and so forth, yeah. and the way you structure a narrative to make everything clear. But he seems experimental at the same time, and so I don't know. He's a good director to talk about if you just want to talk about the cinema, how a certain kind of cinema works.
He's as you say, the ultimate. The master of the universe. Mm-hmm. But he's also, he has such populist appeal too.
Yes, yes. No, that's the other thing. He is a great popular entertainer. And the fact that he can also appeal to high theorists at the same time makes him pretty special. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And I forgot, we didn't really talk about the new feminist readings of his work.
Mm-hmm.
But... That's a whole other subject, really. Mm-hmm. But do you think that further readings of his films have, and all, with all of the feminist criticism, has mm-hmm. that only enhanced his reputation?
Well, I think, yes, I think he was because, maybe because of the Laura Mulvey, famous Laura Mulvey essay, but he was a director that... feminist theory wanted to look at, whether they liked him or not, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think Tanya Modolesky's book is the best statement about him. And it's the glass half full or the glass half empty. And I don't know that anybody has gone beyond that. I'm not aware of a lot of feminist literature on Hitchcock now, but it may be that we went through that whole kind of post-feminist phase, and maybe there's something out now that's dealing with that. But mm-hmm. I'm not aware of a lot of literature on that subject. There are women writing about Hitchcock, but not mm-hmm. not from a feminist, not going over the feminist materials that much. Mm-hmm. I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we will still be poring over his work for. Mm-hmm. years to come, because there's just so much there. It's so rich, and it's so fun. It's so much fun to watch those movies and mm-hmm. analyze them.
Yes, they are very studyable, and in my experience, they don't date very much. I mean, young people today still respond to the great Hitchcock films.
Yeah, Psycho is as creepy as ever.
Mm-hmm.
Jim, before we sign off, I just want to give you a chance to update listeners on what you've been up to lately. Last time you were on, you were, it was just before the Orson Welles Centennial Celebration. So I thought maybe you could tell us about how that went and if you have any projects in the works regarding that.
Yeah, most of my year this past year has been taken up with the Orson Welles brouhaha. And, Indiana here... we have a great cinema here, and it sponsored a really impressive symposium and showing of Welles films. I think there are people from about six different countries and a lot of interesting stuff here. So I was involved in that. And I also went to Woodstock, Illinois, where Welles went to school, and there was a festival there. I visited that. I was supposed to go to Michigan, for complicated reasons, I had to skip out on that one. Now I still have two more lecture gigs before the year's over. But in the midst of that, I brought out a centennial edition of my book on Welles, which is kind of expanded and corrected and has a long introduction. And so that's
okay.
That took time to put that together and get it out on time.
Yes, so. And so that's The Magic World of Orson Welles?
That's right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. Do you have anything, does it include anything on The Other Side of the Wind?
Yes, I added a little bit about it, but Joe McBride and knows a lot more about The Other Side of the Wind than I do, and Jonathan Rosenbaum knows a lot more about it than I do, and Josh Karp has just written a book about it.
That's right.
So, you know, I have not been able to see much of The Other Side of the Wind, and like everyone, I was hoping it would be out by now. But I was able to add some things to what I had said about it, because here at the Lilly Library in Bloomington, we also have Peter Bogdanovich's papers, and there was some interesting stuff about The Other Side of the Wind in that I was able to add.
Okay. So is the updated edition available now?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Fantastic.
It's been out for a couple of months now.
And if listeners are interested, they can pick it up on Amazon?
Sure.
Okay. And that's the way we frame it. Flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, wasn't this just a killer episode? Come let us know what you thought of it on our website, flickswise.com. Or if peering from afar is more your style, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/flickswise. You can find me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. And if you think this podcast was just to die for, be sure to rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes. Tell potential listeners that we are an absolute scream. Also, if you enjoyed this episode, you might want to check out our Mulholland Drive episode, which was Jim's first appearance on the show. On our next episode, more horrors lie ahead. Only this time it's adorable bunnies committing the atrocities. Aaron West of the website Criterion Blues is going to tell us why he thinks the 1978 animated film Watership Down is worthy of the FlixWise favorites list. Until then, Jim, thank you so much for coming on the show again.
Sure, thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely, and I hope to have you on again very soon.
Yeah, great.
Okay, fantastic. Mm. I don't know about you, but I am just dead tired, so until next time, sweet dreams.